from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
Egypt is uniting religious groups. The president doubles down on the wall, and the APA takes a shot at men. That's all coming up on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and homeschool dad. We're just wrapping up our first full week of January, and it's been a doozy. There's been a lot of turmoil in Egypt in recent years, until recently, when the Muslim Brotherhood was pushed out of power. House Democrats went after them for their human rights record, even as Egypt is in the midst of working with Muslims and Coptic Christians to be more unified. Joining Tony to discuss the topic is Representative Jeff Fortenberry of Nebraska, who is also the co-chair of the Caucus on Religious Minorities in the Middle East.
Jeff, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, thanks so much for having me on, and I'm excited to learn of your trip to Egypt, and I really appreciate your deep, abiding interest in the fundamental questions of civilization, which revolve around the sacred space of conscience as it manifests itself in religious freedom, and your willingness to take a particular interest in Egypt, because I don't think we in America, nor really the world, understands just how critical a vibrant, healthy, pluralistic, united Egypt is for peace in the world.
Well, it's geographically and historically, it is positioned at the right place to have an influence literally throughout the Middle East and into Africa. And so I know you track this carefully, but in fact, in the embassy, my conversations over there with governmental personnel, the question was, why this step when they're making the right moves? Why is Congress cutting military funding to a country that really needs it and is, quite frankly, still a little bit unsettled after the Muslim Brotherhood?
Yeah, it's something that I oppose. I don't think it's the right thing to do. Secretary Pompeo did the right thing and released the funding for the military in the recent appropriations bill. But we need to send the right message to Egypt. It's not a perfect place. It's not a thriving liberal democracy and market like we would understand it. However, when President Sisi took office, one of the first things he did was go on to national television and had the Coptic Christian Pope, Tewodros, and the Grand Imam on both sides of him, and he said to the camera, "We are Egyptians." There's a healthy nationalism in Egypt. The opening of this new cathedral and the president's presence there, as well as him inviting Christian leaders to the opening of the Grand Mosque, shows very significant movement toward tolerance and a healthy form of nationalism around the unity of the idea of being Egyptian, but creating this space. I think the United States needs to recognize that. I think the United States has we have a very robust military-to-military exchange and a great set of agreements that go back to 1979. When I went in the Sinai Desert as a young man in 1979, on a twisted pile of concrete and rubble, there were the words scrawled in both English and Arabic, "Here was the war, here is the peace." And that's where the 73 war was fought. Egypt went to great lengths to make peace with Israel. It's been a peace that's held ever since. Because it's been so far behind us 40 years now, we forget just how substantive, how radical this was for Egypt to make a departure and try to seek peace with Israel. We brokered that deal and as a consequence give Israel and Egypt significant amounts of military money. Yes, we want to see certain outcomes in their society and move in the right direction, but the way to do that is to grab the hand of friendship even tighter, not push them away. They're the traditional leader of the Arabic world. They are the seat of antiquity. Again, they have a healthy nationalism. They have approximately 10 million Christians who live there. And if Egypt would have spiraled into defeat and to chaos after the dynamics of the Arab Spring and the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, it would have been absolute disaster, not just for the entire Middle East, but also the entire world. So I think it's the wrong thing to do. I am the co-chair of the Egyptian caucus in Congress. We have to do a good job of explaining to the American people why this investment of funds is important. And Tony, I really apologize. I know you wanted to have a lengthier conversation, but some scheduling problems have come up, and I've got to give a speech on the floor of the House of Representatives in about 30 seconds.
Well, I will let you go speak on the House floor, and I thank you for joining us, and we'll continue this conversation in the future. Jeff Fortenberry,
thank you,
thanks
Tony.
So much for being with us.
You can find out more about Representative Jeff Fortenberry when you head over to TonyPerkins.com. While you're there, why don't you consider helping Family Research Council get this year off on the right foot financially by simply clicking on the donate button. Your help can make all the difference. That website once more is TonyPerkins.com.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener, replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet and share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. On Wednesday, after getting nowhere in negotiations with Democrat leadership, President Trump said he may declare a national emergency and build a wall on our southern border. Joining FRC President Tony Perkins to discuss that possibility is the senior legal fellow at American Civil Rights Union and the senior legal editor for Breitbart News, Ken Klukowski.
Ken, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me, Tony. Happy New Year.
Thank you. It does appear the president is doing his best to try to negotiate with congressional Democrats, but his patience appeared to be running thin, to say the least. What would be the steps the president would have to take to declare a national emergency?
Well, right now, Tony, the president is going the extra mile with Senate Democrats. The law does not require him to negotiate. He is doing so, and I believe he's doing so in good faith, trying to find a negotiated settlement that allows everyone to save face. But in the event that Pelosi and Schumer continue to dig in their heels, opposing a policy that Schumer voted in favor of just years ago, before Trump was president, it's under the National Emergencies Act of 1976. The president has unconditional authority to declare a national emergency for anything. I have a piece out right now on Breitbart News giving the that's going viral right now, giving the history of this. Since that law was passed, there have been 58 declarations of emergency, and those do not need to be short-term things. Of that 58, 31 are still in effect today, including the very first national emergency, which was declared in 1979 by President Jimmy Carter to deal with Iran-sponsored terrorism. So 31 of those 58 are still in force today, contrary to what you're hearing from partisan Democrats and also from hyperventilating media pundits who all of a sudden are calling themselves legal experts. The fact that there's been 31 of these shows how common it is for presidents to do it. If President Trump declares a border emergency, that number just goes from 31 to 32. The authority for him to do so is found in 50 U.S.C. Section 1605. If he does so, Tony, then under another provision of federal law, so again, these are laws passed by Congress. No one's making this up as they go along. Under 33 U.S.C. Section 2293, the Secretary of Defense can then order military units, including the Army Corps of Engineers and the other construction units of the U.S. military, to direct their personnel and their funding and their machinery to construction projects. And so that is how you would be able to build the wall. There are billions of dollars that would be available to DOD to be able to undertake that project if the president decides to declare a national emergency.
So that would be a redirecting of current revenue that's already been authorized by Congress.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. Of course, there is a 2007 statute already on the books where Congress has authorized the construction of a wall. This would just be retasking already approved military appropriations to be able to fund the project that Congress has already authorized by law. That's where the president, despite what you're hearing, again, by some hyper-partisan people on the TV right now, that is where it is just absolutely clear on all four square corners that the president has every aspect of legal authority that he needs to do this. And it's not citing his inherent constitutional authority as commander-in-chief. He does have that as well, but that would be a different discussion. Here it's a matter of just taking use of federal statutes enacted by Congress that are currently on the books as we speak.
So, Ken Kukowski, what would be potential obstacles for the president? I mean, you've laid out that this has been passed by Congress. Congress has given the president, recognized the president has this authority. Could he be challenged in court if he takes this direction of declaring a national emergency?
Well, recent years have shown us that even if you should be able to answer a question like that with a no, the reality is that you'll always find someone who files a lawsuit. And out of over 600 federal trial judges in 94 judicial districts across the nation, if you pick the right judicial districts dominated by left of center judges, you're running pretty good odds that you're going to get a judge who might dare to go where no judge has gone before. So there is certainly that possibility. There are several districts where challengers could file a lawsuit like this. We have seen, unfortunately, and I say this with all due respect because I am a practicing attorney, we have seen some federal judges at the trial level act like they are nothing short of part of the resistance to Donald Trump. We have seen some outrageous judicial activist ruling from certain judges. And for plaintiffs who hire the best lawyers, they know not just what districts to file in, but to also make sure those districts are under the jurisdiction of a U.S. Court of Appeals that's also left-leaning, such as the Fourth Circuit or the Ninth Circuit. And so even on matters where I am fully confident, as he did with the travel ban, that President Trump would prevail at the Supreme Court, they're trying to set up this rearguard action where it can take 12 or 18 months before a matter reaches the high court so that they can restore the proper rule of law on the issue.
Well, Ken, that brings up a really important question. I mean, if we're talking about a national emergency, I mean, that would necessitate quick action. Are there provisions that would allow for this to be fast-tracked, maybe bumped to the Supreme Court, so that the prescribed plan of action that the president is proposing can be taken?
Well, I know how I would do it, and I'm confident that's how the Justice Department would do it, if they had to do a legal strategy. No doubt the persons filing the lawsuits, the plaintiffs, would certainly be asking for a preliminary injunction. They would be asking for a very quick ruling even while the matter is still ongoing in court. So before you would have a trial or even discovery and depositions, they would file briefs asking for an immediate order blocking the president while the case was ongoing. As soon as that preliminary injunction, or PI as we call it, is issued, you could petition immediately for the Court of Appeals there to grant it a stay and to hear the appeal on an expedited basis. Again, if these people are clever enough, as they have been on other issues, such as DACA and transgender troops in the military, if they're clever enough to file in districts that are in appeals courts, that, as I said before, are also the more liberal courts in the country as of today, those stays would be denied and whatnot. As soon as that would happen, you could apply to the U.S. Supreme Court for an emergency stay pending appeal. And also in the alternative, you could also ask for what's called, it's extremely rare, but you could file a Rule 11 cert petition. That is a petition for certiorari before judgment for the Supreme Court to take it up even before the appeals courts have handed down a written opinion. The last time that happened was 2003. So it is unbelievably rare for that to happen. But it's interesting that we're talking about this today, Tony, because tomorrow, on Friday, the Supreme Court will be voting on several Rule 11 petitions for cert before judgment. They'll be voting on the DACA cases and transgenders in the military. So as rare as it is, it could potentially happen. If I had to put my money on something, I'd say the odds are probably better that that the justice overseeing that circuit would just issue a stay, would put their opinion on ice as it goes through the appellate system. But again, we're in something of uncharted waters right now.
All right, Ken, got to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Truly a new day when it comes to the judiciary.
You can find out more about Ken Klukowski, as well as a link to his article on this topic, when you visit TonyPerkins.com. While you're there, why don't you consider helping Family Research Council start out the year financially strong by simply clicking on the donate button. Your help can make all the difference. That website, once more, is TonyPerkins.com.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy, from unicorns to the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. In FRC's analysis, 10 Myths on Abortion, join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. For the first time in its history, the American Psychological Association released guidelines concerning men and boys, saying that so-called traditional masculinity not only is, quote, harmful, but also could lead to homophobia and sexual harassment. Joining us to put it all in perspective is Dr. Jesse Gill, a licensed psychologist in private practice and author of the book Face to Face, 7 Keys to a Secure Marriage. Here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Dr. Gill, welcome to Washington Watch.
Tony, it's good to be with you today.
I mean, again, as I said a few moments ago, nothing new, the attack on masculinity. But this is different because this is coming from respected institution, the American Psychological Association, which carries a lot of weight with counselors across the country.
It does, Tony. And of course, there is a risk here for counselors and psychologists, even those who don't necessarily espouse the full doctrinal ideology of the APA, to have sort of a knee-jerk reaction to these kinds of guidelines, and also sort of the short summary statements that are made within the guidelines, as opposed to really delving in to this issue as a whole. So, you know, there's potential here for folks who are in the trenches, such as myself, to, you know, use this in sort of a knee-jerk manner to promote agendas that are not consistent with what individual clients need, and certainly not respecting a Christian view of masculinity and the ideals of men as Christ followers, as we would espouse in the church.
Would you also add that a historical view of manhood?
In the sense of that this is an attack on a historical view of manhood?
Right. I mean, we see men as those that they're the protectors, they're the defenders. I mean, there is a role for men in society. That's why I believe God made men and women. We have different roles. Sometimes those roles are in the same area. They're complementary. But I think men are needed.
Oh, absolutely, Tony. And when men are functioning in their roles in the family and in the church, for those men who are not married, you know, we all benefit, and we see aspects of, you know, God Himself. And this is absolutely aspects of this are absolutely an attack, because you have to remember that the APA is not approaching this from a Christian perspective. It's from a humanist perspective. I'm sure there are feminist influences as well, and it's much of this is very different than our view as Christians. You know, we've always been countercultural. You know,
right.
So there are. I guess a broad way to look at this is that all humans have aspects that are, you know, part of our sin nature. So, you know, some of the highlights from this article is they talk about aspects of masculinity that include stoicism, competitiveness, dominance, and aggression, that those things are harmful. And, you know, as Christians, we've known for millennia that dominance and aggression are not what God has called us to. And the example of Christ, you know, he leads us to actually surrender and dying right. to self. But a person, sort of a knee-jerk reaction, or somebody who's not being thoughtful about this, they could look at aspects of this, such as competitiveness, or not really appreciating the call for men to be strong, the call for us to be leaders, and you could use these types of guidelines to squelch the expressions of those things in men. As Christian men, we've been called to be servant leaders, those who protect, those who are strong, and those who die to self. So we don't need the APA to instruct us on those things. But I think the real danger would be for people who are approaching this from a humanist standpoint or from a knee-jerk reaction to use some of this to promote agendas and ideologies that are not at all consistent with the Christian worldview. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does make sense. I mean, when you look at the competitiveness, stoicism, the domineering nature of manhood, all of those things of unrestrained by the Holy Spirit. I mean, that's what we're
right.
all fallen
that's
in our nature.
Right.
But God takes right. those things and those distinct aspects of male and female, and when they're submitted to Him, that's when things work. But it appears here that what the APA wants to do is throw to use a phrase, throw the baby out with the bathwater or the man with the tub. I mean, he wants to get rid of him and make everybody the same. And that's not the way we're created.
No, we are created male and female. We each have specific giftings and strengths. And as Christians, of course, we're supposed to bring those giftings and strengths, all of us, under the mutual submission to good King Jesus. And so, you know, there's a risk with the APA new guidelines, again, for people who are wanting to promote an agenda that tears down. And so, I mean, I think if you want to go at this at the spiritual level, Tony, mm-hmm. because there are people who don't want to submit to the lordship of good King Jesus, and any kind of semblance of authority is threatening, you know, there's a risk for people who don't want any kind of authority at all to try to push back against and push down any kind of healthy male authority.
Right.
So
well,
that certainly is probably an undercurrent in some of the agenda that's behind these guidelines.
Well, and this should be a motivation, in my view, it should be a motivation for pastors to preach on a biblical manhood. In fact, you know, I'm thinking of Ephesians where you talk about submission. Wives, submit to your husbands. Oh, people go apoplectic when they hear that. Their eyes roll back in their head. The left just goes ballistic. But if they would read the rest of it, that men are to love their wives as Christ loved the church. And see, that's where I think the crisis is that men are not living out biblical manhood, which is it is strong. It is protective. They are the protector. They are the provider. I know that may sound chauvinistic, but I think that's the way God created it, in partnership with their wife and in such a way that their wife willingly follows their leadership, because as Christ laid down his life for the church, so the husband lays down his desires and aspirations for his wife to see her fulfilled.
It's true, Tony. And, you know, the ills in the world are not because of men being men. The ills in the world are because of humans' sin and living and abiding by our sin nature. And so when Jesus, through the Apostle Paul, calls us for women to submit and respect and honor, and for men basically to die to self, he is specifically looking at some of the areas that would be most prominent for men and women within marriages, which is something that I speak about routinely, areas that need to be surrendered, areas that need to die to self. I want to agree with you also and say that this whole discussion gives us the opportunity to talk about a Christian approach to masculinity. And, of course, our our Savior, but also our example is Jesus, who was absolutely strong. I mean, of course, we know that he was a carpenter, worked with his hands, but he was also thoughtful, and he also devoted his life to serving others, and then ultimately to lay down his life and die on the cross for all of us. So there's been no greater example in history of true strength as a man, true servant leadership, and within that, of course, his approach to loving as opposed to doing behaviors that are motivated by fear.
Could part of the crisis in manhood be actually created by those who are now attacking? I mean, when you think of Hollywood creating an image of what manhood is, that is not reflective of true biblical manhood. But they seem to be teaming up with the feminists to eliminate masculinity and manhood.
Yeah, I don't think that Hollywood gets to be the voice that informs us about what true masculinity is, you know, and whether that was an older version of that or a modern version of that. You know, they've never, I don't think they've ever had it right.
Right.
And, you know, as I am a Christian and I, of course, daily submit to Christ, and he calls me to die to self on a regular basis. So sometimes, you know, those are moments when I need to step forward and be strong instead of shirking away in fear. I need to be bold. I need to be courageous. You know, look at his challenge to Joshua, be strong and very courageous as you face all of the foes that are in the promised land. And other times, you know, Christ calls me to die to self. So you're not going to find a message like that in Hollywood. In the olden times, it was perhaps, you know, more appealing to our sensibilities that we want to never die and we want to be immortal and invincible. And nowadays, you know, of course, too often it appeals to the sexual side of males.
Right,
and
right.
All of these things need to be under the submission to good King Jesus. And we have this opportunity now to reflect that. Yes, sir.
Dr. Jesse Gill, thank you so much. Out of time. I want to thank you for joining us and appreciate your thoughts on this. And again, this is an issue we're going to be talking about for a while because I think it is very significant in its implications.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.